Hey everybody, welcome to This AnthroLife. As always, this is Adam Gamble, happy to be here with you today. We are digging into our archives, one of our favorite episodes from back in the day called The Happiness Fetish, in which Ryan, Neil, and myself discuss questions of happiness and why humans search for it, as well as one of the most provocative ideas that why is happiness something that we make an object of our desire and how do we work towards it? And then also, why do our imaginings or what we imagine about the future always seem to leave us a little bit short? Why do they seem to fail us? So we're going to dig into that conversation and enjoy it with you. Let you know that we do this from time to time because we're bringing you a ton of new content and we have some awesome episodes in the pipeline, but it takes a little time to edit them because, you know, we are essentially a two-person show that makes it. And then we have a lot of awesome team kind of helping us in the background set up other, you know, social media and working with booking guests, etc. So thanks to our team, you know, and we're going as fast as we can, doing as much work as we can to get you more content and episodes. We're excited to do it, and we can't wait to share them with you. So for now, we hope you enjoy this episode of The Archives called The Happiness Fetish.
Hello, hello. This is Ryan Collins, and my MacBook makes me happy.
This is Neil Tripathi, and gardening makes me happy.
This is Adam Gamble, and my cat makes me happy.
So we're talking about, right now, are things that make us happy. And the focus of this episode is on the happy fetish. Now, let's get more specific about what we mean about the happy fetish. And one way I'm going to talk about this today is by bringing attention to a lot of surveys that have been conducted lately to talk about happiness in sort of levels, to quantify happiness, to say that some cities are happier than others, that some countries and states are happier than others. But the data, the statistics used to make all these associations are often directed at a thing, an idea that is associated with happiness. In and of itself is not happiness. And that's why we're directing it as a fetish. Adam, maybe you could explain to us what a fetish is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, kind of the idea of fetish, you know, it's made most famous from Sigmund Freud, right, the psychoanalyst. But and it sort of has interesting connotations of sexuality and sort of this disavowal of something that's taboo. But again, we can extrapolate that because the fetish is a much more useful heuristic, a way to think about things, particularly with happiness in this case. And so I think it's a great way to introduce the topic is that the fetish is, in a general sense, is something that points to something else. It sort of masks what's actually there. And so, I mean, the way it's been used in traditional anthropological theory, if you want to think of it, I mean, just take a general example of sort of a general African totem that a European colonialist would come find. There's a wooden statue that it seems that people are worshiping. But what Europeans point out, of course, well, the statue itself isn't a god. It's just the thing. It's this material thing that is pointing towards this idea of the deity, right? Now, of course, this idea is expanded that every single culture has a kind of fetish, right? You know, it began sort of in this old school saying that other people have fetishes, but Europeans came to be found that fetishes, most famously, as Marx points out, in commodities, in money itself, as pointing towards what it means to be well. Mm-hmm. So fetish is any material kind of thing. In this case, we're also talking about notions of statistics or data sets that also right. say, here's what happiness is. But of course, the fetish itself is not the thing. The wooden statue is not a god. Money is not happiness, but they point towards it.
Exactly.
Right? In some ways, they might even enable these kinds of relationships.
And with this, I think, you know, happiness, it seems to work so well with happiness, right? Because so much of the advice given to people on how to achieve happiness is about trying to disavow happiness and focus on the process to getting to be happy, mm. right?
Yeah.
Which is almost trying to disregard the fetish and go to what the process of fetishizing, right?
Right.
And I think, you know, our examples that we're going to look at right now with Dan Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness, as well as the film Happy from 2011, I think really show a way to focus on what might allow it make us happy, right? Instead of just thinking about happiness itself.
Exactly. And so thinking about maps where people are seeing states that are ranked as being happier than one another, These are created by using any different number of criteria to link to something we think correlates to happiness. So one study by the University of Vermont uses this analysis of words used on Twitter to try and correlate what cities and what states are happier than others. And with this information, you find that Asheville, North Carolina, Green Bay, Wisconsin, and about 7 or 8 cities in California are all of the top ranking. However, if you use other types of correlations with well-being, you find that places like Portland, Oregon, and Boston, Massachusetts are also at the top of this happiness list. And this is produced in Business Insider.
Hmm.
So you see the one group from the University of Vermont is using data that's corresponding more with the way people are using and engaging with digital media. But Business Insider is talking about well-being, but also in related to monetary income.
Hmm. Well, I mean, again, that points to right again, because obviously Business Insider or things like The Economist even, right, even the little more leftists, is they talk about certain indicators, right? And this is kind of what the idea of the fetish comes in, right? What things are pointing to happiness in this case, right? And this, it's interesting, too, because even with, like, the University of Vermont study, it's tagging the idea of what kind of words are being used, right? And Business Insider is pointing to sort of financial aspects related to that. So even notions of language and how we talk about happiness, of course, you know, register certain ways on you know, if we're measuring what it is to be happy, right?
Completely. And the funny thing about measuring, right, is that human beings, as Dan Gilbert argues, right, in the Stumbling on Happiness, are incredibly bad at predicting what makes them happy,
mm-hmm.
right? So we can say, as the Business Insider is trying to do, right, maybe that money will bring us happiness, that
mm-hmm.
these certain quantitative indicators will work. But then a lot of times it doesn't, right? And Gilbert, you know, points to three ways and how our imagination fails with regards to happiness. One, imagination tends to add and remove details,
uh-huh.
but people do not recognize that key details may be fabricated or missing already. And then two, imagined futures and pasts are more like the present than they actually will be. So, you know, it's not, the future isn't some far off thing, you're living the future almost, right? And then three, imagination fails to realize that things will feel different once they actually happen, right? We adjust to things. You know, sometimes you get a brand new car, you're really happy, and then a week later you don't, you know, that happiness still isn't there, and you projected when you
mm-hmm.
spent that $200,000 that you'd be happier much longer.
Exactly. And thinking about these points, we can really take this to, you know, use some examples right here. The imagination tends to add and remove details, but people do not realize that the key details may be fabricated or missing from an imagined scenario. So these maps that we're seeing correlating happiness to a place that we seem to be fabricating, regardless of what we're using, whether it's
mm.
Twitter, whether it's monetary income, whether it's a general sense of health in a city, but that somehow happiness is a place.
Hmm.
That New York, on this one study, is unfortunately the least happiest city to be in, second only by Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
However, you see, again, like Portland and so many cities in California and Boston showing up higher across these surveys. So even though there's something fabricated about the cities, they're still directing you towards a place.
Hmm.
And that's a great thing to think about, right? There's always, I think, in American culture, we fetishize cities as well. We believe that, you know, New York
mm-hmm.
might solve all your problems, right? Can go,
right.
It's like...
city
what's
dreams.
It? Oh, exactly. I mean, there's all of these ideas of going to particular locations and finding your dream, right? But then
absolutely.
I think what you're hitting on is completely right, Ryan, that so much is left out, right, when we just portray these places. And try to, you know, just say this place is happier than that place,
right?
And whatnot.
Exactly. And so we'll take a look at the second point, that imagined futures and pasts are more like the present than they actually will be or were. Now, one of the things that these surveys has brought up is that statistical correlation is often wrong because of issues such as tourism.
Hmm.
Because in that sense, the people who are going to certain areas are romanticizing. They have different visions of what this space actually is than the people who really dwell there on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
So you have cities in Florida that appear much happier than any other place in Florida. Like Orlando has a huge spike, or Jacksonville is actually the top least happy cities. But then you also have the strange issue of New York, because New York is romanticized on TV and movies
sure.
with past that we constantly go back to. But for some reason, it's not catching up with the on-the-ground statistics that we see elsewhere.
Hmm.
So we have these different visions of what we think happiness is, and then how it actually seems to be, they don't always match up.
Sure. And I mean, the point is just the interesting connection or disconnection between things like statistics as well as our personal imaginations, right? And I think that one of the things that helps us think about this that Gilbert points out is that, you know, a better indicator of what might make us happy in sort of like seeing other people being happy is what other people actually do, right? And so there is, again, this disconnect between like what we think we're doing, our imaginative capacity versus watching other people do things, right? This, of course, isn't a key to finding happiness, because seeing your neighbor be happy doesn't mean you will be happy if you do the same thing your neighbor does, because you're a different person. You have a different scenario, a different context. However, it is a much better indicator of success if you see other people, you know, being happy, and you can work within that in that realm. You know, again, obviously, buying the same car your neighbor has is always one of those famous commercials of any car commercial. Like, you know, you see the neighbor looking, you know, with green eyes over at their other neighbor who just bought the new Honda or something. You know, and it's like, oh, great car. You know, and they're kind of talking about it. And like, you could be happy too if you bought this car.
Again, we're talking about the happy fetish. In that regards,
right.
We're marketing the car as the thing
as
that
the
brings
thing.
Happiness.
Right. But it's interesting, too, because what Gilbert kind of points out is, like, there's this sort of, like, co-psychology here of, like, if you watch your friends be happy, you, too, then have a much better, much better way of finding happiness, that capacity, because you already relate to your friends.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. You don't relate to your neighbor because they have a car, necessarily. You could, I guess, but...
And then in this relation, we might find intentionality, right? People,
mm-hmm.
you might start making a plan on how you want to be happy, right? Looking at your friends who seem more relaxed. So you might start being intentional in your activities. And in the film Happy that came out in 2011, they really talk about this, how according to a lot of research in psychology, 50% of your kind of mood fluctuation is genetic. But then of the other 50%, 40% of that is intentional decision making.
Mm.
You know, so you can influence your level of elevated mood or happiness,
sure,
by focusing on things that you have a positive feedback, right? And looking at your everyday experience, it's almost very anthropological, right? And
right.
trying to
mm-hmm.
go out there and actually see how you react to certain activities, whether you like jogging in the morning or if you like sleeping in more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was really curious to see how they framed happiness as a spectrum, that your genetic biology is going to rest within this general 50% area that could be different for different people of different genetic backgrounds. But still, your choices, your culture, your upbringing, your surroundings, that's 40% of what your happiness is.
Mm.
By putting yourself around that other happy person, you just might get that extra bump past where you normally would be.
Yeah, it's a great point just to think about, and again, this connection of environment and individual self, right? And this is, again, Michael Jackson, the anthropologist, you know, course of existential anthropology, right? It's always this tension between our genetic selves, our individual, who we think we are, and our visions of ourselves versus the environment in which where we're born, what culture we're into, what economic status we have, what class we're in, et cetera, et cetera. And it's the finding that the space between the tension. This is kind of where I like Anita brought up the notion of intentionality. This is where this kind of comes out. Is that, do you feel a sense of control in this way? That you can actually try to be intentional about what it is that you're feeling and thinking, who you're putting yourself with. I mean, obviously you can't change your culture. You can't change your class overnight anyway. However, learning to be intentional about your actions at the psychological level, that's being aware of your genetic predispositions, your psychological self, your immediate environment, and trying to find a sense, like, what ways and how can you be intentional about approaching these?
And actually, in Happy, they also say that the 50% of the possibility that's not genetic, actually only 10% is what you're born into, what your class is, your socioeconomic level. So you have that, which is 10%, but then the intentionality is even separate from that, right?
Wow.
So, you know, regardless of where you are in, you have this control. And I think this control also relates to freedom, right?
Mm.
The idea of, what people feel they have the possibility to do with their own intentionality.
Sure. I mean, it seemed to think about, that's what Amartya Sen writes about with food and freedom. And just coming to kind of think about, to expand what you're saying, is that basically there's a kind of a negative and a positive sense of freedom here that we can think about. In sort of the positive sense of the freedom to do something, I have the freedom to talk about political issues. I have the freedom to get food. And there's the negative issue, which is freedom from something. I am free from hunger. You know?
Right.
And they both matter. And again, this is sort of, as you're saying, thinking about notions of intentionality too. Right? What are you free to do? What are you free from do? What are you free from? You know? And again, those can certainly affect the way that we're talking about how we approach happiness, right?
Absolutely. And cross-culturally, we know that some cultures will try to avoid getting to too high of a level of happiness because it can be seen as a detriment. Something can be seen as off. And there are different various social factors for why this may come into being.
Of course, there's the classic essay by Bohannon, Christmas in the Kalahari, right, where amongst the Bushmen, it's realized that if someone kills, so this anthropologist,
Paul Bohannon
kills, you know, a very big animal, I figure it's a buffalo or some very large, or a cow, to feed a big celebration. So, because he wants to kind of give a Christmas to the Bushmen. And, but then once he presents this animal, he thinks is, you know, very meaty, could be a great meal. Everyone immediately starts knocking him down and saying, you know, it's so scrawny, why'd you insult us and all this?
Yeah.
but then he realizes, you know, this is a way of kind of keeping people in check, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the social group is enforced and, you know, no one can kind of gloat too much, right? It's all
sure.
brought into the community, really.
It keeps in mind, the notion of imagination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's keeping that from one going purely into ego or purely into the imagination. It's like, I'm so great. Look, I killed this big cow for everybody and I'm bringing the best dinner ever.
Absolutely. I see this with my own field work. I always go jogging. It's something I just like to do. And with the ancient Maya people, or not ancient Maya, I work with modern Maya people. And they were laughing because when they saw me, they equated me to being a deer that was hunted.
Hmm.
I was like, oh, no humans, Ron. You're just a hunted deer.
It's funny, right? Yeah, because he's saying, I'm gonna look better. I'm going to feel better by running. And it does make you feel better, of course. But at the same time,
exactly.
right, communally, it's like, well, yeah, okay, you look like a deer. it's interesting to see these sort of checks and balances, right, that it's like, we want to promote happiness, but this is both examples are great to think about notions of community happiness, right?
Oh, completely.
And it's sort of this level of again, this like co-psychology, right?
Mm.
Of working together. Minds working together in this space.
Yeah, it's a way, it's, you know, trying to, it almost limits competition, right? And people trying to, instead of, you know, getting happiness from ego boosts, get it from, you know, community participation through, you know, kind of a humility. And also going back to Gilbert, kind of, you know, focusing also on your own intentionality in your actions, as opposed to really trying to do things that you think other people will praise you for.
Sure. I mean, even the idea that again, Gilbert points out that one of the best ways to find indicators of happiness is to see what other people do.
Mm-hmm.
These are both clear communal examples that the community is telling somebody how to be happy, right? You look like a fool because you look like a deer. Or this brought this really scrawny cow. What are you thinking? You know, they're great examples to think about because it's actually an overt way of the community saying, here's how we think together, right?
And what are the possibilities for happiness therein?
Right.
So I think, you know, with this really ties into our beginning of, you know, what makes us happy.
Exactly.
And it's a variety, right? But we can, you know, we're all free to try out. And in this world, there's just such a multiplicity of things to try to be happy. So you might want to try, you know, for me, gardening.
Yeah, and for me, my cat.
Exactly. For me, coffee.
Coffee's a beautiful thing, yeah.
Now, as Guy Raz said on a recent NPR TED Talk, there is no secret to happiness. We all understand what it is, but it's about the communities and the context that pull us together.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. Again, this is Adam Gamel for This Anthro Life. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. We'll be back next week with some brand new content where I'll be doing some episodes with our colleague Matt Arnst, who you've heard him on the Freethink 6 episode, Who Are the 13,000, where we kind of dig into the idea of doing user research, which we are still doing. So again, if you're interested in participating in a survey with us, either over Skype for interviews or if we can just send you the written survey, we'd love to get to know more about our listeners and what you like, what you don't like, why you might listen to TAL, why you might not, etc. And so it's going to help us, you know, bring you better content that's going to be more tailored to you and what you're looking for. So if you want to participate, it's free. We need about 10 to 20 minutes of your time. Hopefully you're down for it. If so, drop us a message on Twitter or send us an email at thisanthrolife@gmail.com, and we will send you some more information. So we're excited about that. So Matt and I will be bringing you some episodes on design anthropology very shortly. We'll tell you more about that as those come out. As well as I want to let you know that we're brought into collaboration, as always, with our friends at the American Anthropological Association, and they've got their annual meeting coming up in November. It's going to be November 29th through December 3rd, so just at the end of the month, right after Thanksgiving if you're in the U.S., and we recommend checking it out. The theme this year is Anthropology Matters, and so it's going to be really cool because we're looking at different ways that anthropology impacts the world, and, you know, This Anthro Life is one of our major things. We will be presenting on panels. We're excited to talk about the podcast as as researchers, as scholars, as well as podcasters ourselves. We'll be presenting also with different panels. Ryan and myself will be on some, Neil will be there. So it's going to actually be really a great time. It's going to be a lot of fun. We have a lot of cool things to share. We'll tell you more about those as we get close. And with further ado, we will see you next week with a new episode. Peace.